Okay, welcome everybody. So glad you're here. Rain and books go well together, I think. I'm Jessica Keener, and I'm moderating today. I'm so excited to be talking about these three great, amazing novelists. I've read all their books. They're wonderful. They really create their own world, unique world, and they sweep you up. So buy the books. And I'll remind you about buying these books and where you can get the books in the back of the room, and then you can get signing outside this room. But I'll remind you at the end of our session here. And we'll leave a little bit of time at the end for a couple of Q&As. So I think what we'll first start with is introducing our wonderful panelists here. What's kind of cool, too, is we have two debut authors who happen to be sitting next to each other and a more seasoned novelist. So I knew you were going to react to that word, seasoned. I thought, I'm going to use that word, and that's it.
When the sound guy was taping on the microphone, he said, oh, could you just tape everything back? I mean, that would be really helpful.
He didn't.
And of course, our topic is called Hilarity and Heartache, and I immediately zone in on the heartache part, so maybe I'll learn something about hilarity by the end of all this. So Chelsea Johnson is originally from northern Minnesota and recently moved to Flagstaff, Arizona, with her partner and two dogs to teach in the undergrad MFA programs at Northern Arizona University. Stray City is her first novel. Her stories have also appeared in One Story, Plowshares, NPR's Selected Shorts, and other places. She received an MFA from Iowa and a Wallace Stegner Fellowship from Stanford, and I guess you're working on another novel. Mm-hmm. So, okay, impressive. Andrew, also a debut novelist. Andrew's stories have appeared in the Paris Review. I can't pronounce the Z one.
I know, Ziziva.
Yeah, and Tin House, Flash Friday series. His nonfiction has appeared in The New Yorker and The New York Review of Books, Washington Post, and others. And you have a new collection of stories that will be coming out in 2020 called Bad Feelings. I like that title. Mm-hmm. And has received fellowships from McDowell, Colony, and New Cross Foundation. So his book is early work. And finally, Stephen, who's published seven novels, right? This is your seventh?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So Stephen, his first novel, Object of My Affection, he wrote for an MFA thesis at Columbia University, right? And your professor sent it to an agent. This is like a dream thing. It was accepted by Simon & Schuster, and then Fox bought an option to the film, and then it was made into a film. Jennifer Aniston starred in the movie. And now
that was a nightmare, but anyway, go ahead.
Was it? You don't have to tell me more about that. Anyway, I think you've had how many other movies made from your...
Two in France.
Two more in France, so they don't count because it's over there somewhere. Right. Your current novel, My Ex-Life, national bestseller, Indie Next Pick, Amazon Top 20 Editor's Pick for Spring 2018, and you've taught at UMass, Wellesley, Harvard, and now currently you co-direct the creative writing program at Brandeis.
Yes.
All right, so... the books are they're so unique and different, and which is what I love about them all. But I think what I'm going to do first, but there's a certain common themes in terms of escaping something, going towards something, maybe not being sure what you're going toward, the struggle, sort of this push and pull that goes on internally for all the protagonists. But I think I'm going to ask Andrew if you wouldn't mind give me a short recap of what early work is about.
So the book is about these young writers living in Charlottesville, Virginia, and they're struggling to define themselves. The narrator of most of the book is this guy, Peter, who's a very unpleasant young man, or, you know, depending on your perspective on how one should conduct oneself. And he's an aspiring novelist, and he meets this young woman named Leslie, who is also a writer, and he kind of falls head over heels into a relationship with her. Unfortunately, he's attached already to the woman he's living with, or not as tightly as attached as she thought they were, and all kinds of trouble ensues following this relationship.
Okay, thanks. And I'm going to ask you, Chelsea, also to just give a little, I'm going to have a little recap so we have some context and then we can start talking a little bit more about maybe some themes or not common themes.
Sounds good. So Stray City takes place, the bulk of the book takes place in Portland, Oregon in the late 90s. And it is about a 24-year-old struggling artist named Andrea Morales who has escaped her rural Nebraska childhood to come to Portland where she's created a family for herself amongst the queer community, kind of queer punk community that was and still is so robust in that area. And then everything goes to hell when she crosses enemy lines and secretly hooks up with a man. And don't read the inside flap if you don't want spoilers. It tells too much.
Oh,
let's just say mayhem ensues. So it's about the families we choose and the families we make and the way that all kinds of identity can be sort of fundamentalist and restrictive in their own ways, even as they also sort of sustain and support us.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's the challenge, I think, of talking about books when people, you know, either maybe a few of you have read the books, but we don't want to give things away, so we'll sort of circle around things. So,
And my ex-life is about David and Julie, who were married in their early 20s and divorced in their early 20s, which I think is common when people marry in their early 20s. And after they separated, they kind of decamped to opposite coasts. David moved to California, and Julie moved to a town very much like Rockport, Massachusetts, which is a place some of you may know. And 30 years later, they reconnect, and in very different terms. I mean, David has come out as gay, and Julie has remarried and has a teenage daughter. And the question sort of posed by the book is it possible to find happiness by reconfiguring your ex-life in new and different terms that make sense for your current situation?
Well, I think that's a perfect question to ask all of you. And I want to know if you had that struggle in terms of when you were formulating your characters and your situation, just how you arrived at that, you know, and how you worked with those inner conflicts with the characters, or if the character came first, or the idea came first. Mm-hmm. Anyone can dive in. We don't have to go in order.
Yeah.
Do you want to go first?
No.
Oh, great. I'll take it.
Go for it.
For me, the book arose out of the voice of the characters, especially out of this sort of narcissistic male voice. And I sort of just started, I found this voice and started kind of writing with it and to see where it ended up. And it was interesting to me to try to work with material that was at hand. You know, I lived in Virginia for a few years. Many of my friends are writers. It's a world I know. The book is not strictly autobiographical, but it is drawing from the world that I come from. And so it was very much an attempt to sort of paint a portrait of that phase of life and of that kind of milieu in a way. So it's kind of a group portrait arising from a particular voice that was important to me. Mm.
Well, I want to read something that I pulled from your book, and I just want to ask you about it since you're talking. So this is Leslie, who Peter falls in love with. And so she's, a lot of this group, they're all sort of into art and literature, and in some ways it seems to me places almost in the head, sort of the intellectual world is sort of creates a place in your novel.
Yeah. But they're more in their heads than in the
more,
world.
More in their heads.
Yeah.
So Leslie, she says, in general, was a sucker for minimalism, and she's talking about art, actually Saul DeWitt or something, in both its quietest and most important forms. She worried that it might be because it echoed some fundamental emptiness at the heart of her idea of things, some inability to understand and process the world in all its richness and complexity. And I'm just wondering, you know, if there was some kind of hollowness that you were trying to find or fill or in creating this world or exploring this character.
Oh, yeah, I'm empty inside. I'm like completely dead inside.
Great question.
For sure. And life has been an endless quest to find like enough books and movies and art to like fill the void like at the center of everything. And the book's kind of about that, you know, like what do you got? You know, you kind of start with nothing and then you try to fill it up with something. And so they're going for art and books and other people, and they're just sort of like hungry for stuff and filling their lives with stuff. And mm-hmm. I think that they sort of realize the limitations of that approach as the book goes on, because suddenly you kind of hit a wall and it's like you can't just keep doing that forever. You have to deepen your understanding of the world. You have to somehow moderate and chill out a little bit. I think that's something that probably has to happen.
Yeah, big question mark. I don't know. Yeah, right.
They're not there yet, at the least.
It's such a book lover's book, you know? I mean, there are just so many books are mentioned in it, and the characters are always reading, and I loved that aspect of it, you know? Mm-hmm. I thought, so for book lovers, it's, it gives you a lot of ideas for books to read, actually.
I don't think there are any of those.
So that makes me think, again, this sense of sort of escaping, which makes me think of your book, Chelsea, and I want to read something. I kind of selected a few little quotes. I mean, the thing about these books, all of them, is I was underlining and putting little stars. They're just all, aside from the story, wonderful, rich language in these books, so mm-hmm. something to really enjoy. So Andrea, who's the protagonist in Chelsea's book, she says something. She says, "Double life was my specialty, honed during my teen years, my formative mode. I picked it right back up. I remembered how alert a secret makes you, how the fear becomes a sharpness and widens your eyes. When you're always watching, you see more." And I love this idea of secret, and it seems like that's something I'll talk to you too, Steve, because the idea of secrets and sort of creating some kind of shadow secret world seemed to be in all of your novels, but I was just curious. If you could just talk a little bit about that idea.
Yeah, well, definitely it's part of the tension of the story is what happens mm-hmm. When you have to keep this, she starts out keeping this secret of her queerness from her family in Nebraska, right? And living that double life in order to protect the real self, you create the sort of false self, and that's what the outside world responds to. But then, of course, when she's in Portland with her queer family, there's another kind of orthodoxy. And I wanted to write about, I found that it was a useful way to write about queer identity, especially that particular kind of really intense queer punk lesbian identity of that particular time period, was by putting a challenge to it. And what would be a greater challenge than transgressing, right? Than like crossing the line, like sleeping with a guy. So again, she finds herself creating this secret self, you know, mm-hmm. even within that. And also on sort of a larger level, I feel like that world, which was and still is, although I no longer live in Portland, such a vibrant, vital world, is also kind of a secret from the rest of the world. It was such a miraculous, like, incredible subculture that I felt like I never saw represented in books or movies or TV or anything like that. And so in a way, writing the book was kind of revealing the secret.
Did you worry about that at all?
Totally.
About, like, revealing things that people wouldn't want you
constantly
to reveal?
Especially because, like, as a child of the 90s, it's like, I'm selling out. I'm selling out my people.
Oh, wow.
Just like Reality Bites.
Yeah, right? I was like, okay, I'll use the term gold star, but I'm not going to explain it. You just have to know it.
Okay, so can I ask you what it is now that you've just thrown that out there?
A gold star lesbian, and I feel like this is actually sort of a destructive term that is also increasingly irrelevant as gender becomes less binary, is a lesbian who's never slept with a man. I think maybe gay men use that term too.
Oh.
If you've never actually, yeah.
Clueless so. Here. Okay.
So there's a band called the Gold Stars. There's like little gay Easter eggs and
okay.
like that.
Okay. So
now you know. One more secret revealed.
Do you feel that like that letting out the secret diminishes the sort of charge or the energy or excitement around that world? Like, does it fade once that secret's out?
I don't think so. I think because it still exists in such a really present, palpable, vibrant way, like when you're in it. But I think it's also, like, I grew up in a small town in the middle of northern Minnesota, and I learned about Riot Girl from Newsweek, you know? Like, I would never have known if it weren't for some kind of mainstream outlet, which the Riot Girls were furious about because they had a media blackout at the time or whatever. But so I think there is, sure, like, maybe it lets out some of the tension in a way, but you also have a chance to reach somebody who would benefit or, like, who would love to discover it. We all have to get there somewhere, you know. We're not born cool.
Right. Like, well, I don't know. So, okay. So, in Steve, in your book, or Never Be Cool. So you have there's this teenager Mandy. You know, as you said, that the protagonist has come to see his former wife, ex-wife, whatever, and their teenage daughter is struggling to get into college, and that's what he does. David does as a profession. So I have this little quote from Mandy. Which is sort of the opposite a little bit of some of the struggles in the characters in the other books, but I'll just read it to you quickly. Mandy, this is the teenager, when she saw a movie in which a character was doing stupid or crazy things because they wanted to experience everything to find out about life, she was filled with wary admiration, mostly because they were brave enough to be irresponsible. For herself, she always thought there was a better approach to figuring out about life, like maybe using your imagination, or for that matter, Google. That was funny. Usually she backed away from that edge of dangerous experience and steep cliffs and took the cautious route home. Then she got angry at her parents for raising her to be a coward. As she stood in the greasy kitchen, she felt she had an opportunity to make up for all that. So I was just sort of intrigued because it's almost as if, you know, one way or the other, it's like we're always, I don't know, is there, we're, I don't want to say we're always caught in that sort of wanting to mess things up, or if we haven't messed things up, we're going to mess it up, or if we've messed it up, we want to unmess it up. I'm just curious if you were sort of thinking about some of that.
I think that my sense of like plot is very weak, and I don't particularly like reading books with a big plot, and you know, where there's something. And I always think of my books as just the characters gradually approaching honesty with themselves about who they are and what they really want out of life, even if they can't get it. And I think that's particularly strong when you're a teenager and you don't really know who you are and what you should be pursuing. And so for that character, you know, she's very insecure and very doesn't really understand what her talents are. She suspects that she has some kind of talent and strength, but she doesn't know what it is. And when she encounters an older man who's dealing with her in ways that might be inappropriate, she's very vulnerable to that because, you know, he says, "I know what your talents are," and so who doesn't want to hear that, especially at that age? And then the kind of job of the novel is to unravel all the lies that people have been telling themselves for a long time.
Yeah, I think we're all sort of fascinated by the lies that we tell ourselves and or the lies that we create and what all that means. This is sort of a general question for anyone. What was maybe the easiest part of writing your books?
I loved writing places. I had left Portland, I had moved to go teach, and so I was like in Northeast Ohio, and it was such a wonderful way to like put myself back into that time and place. I loved like describing the interior of a room or like a rock, you know, a gross rock club with its layers of posters and its smoke smell and all that stuff like that, or just even the weather and the sky. For me, that was like the easiest and most pleasurable thing, was just going somewhere that I loved in my mind and putting myself there.
You used a cool word, palimpsest, I think it
was.
Which is like sort of the layers of life. Uh-huh. I thought that was so cool.
At the Club Satyricon, you know, all those like years and years of show posters that just accumulate on the walls.
And the leftover staples.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder what was attached to them like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love writing dialogue. That's my favorite thing to do. And I've been teaching it this past week. In my classes, so that's been fun. But I don't know, I just have these, a lot of the scenes in the book are sort of these set pieces of people sitting around and talking over drinks or over dinner and things like that. And I would get carried away, and like every dialogue scene in the book used to be about 2 to 3 times as long as it is. My editor said, "I think you're just having these conversations in your head, aren't you? And you're just sort of like going, you're just following them till the end of the conversation. But you need to like
that has no end,
right? You need to like reduce it down to the actual relevant character material here. You can't just have them talking forever. Whereas if left to my own devices, the book would be 500 pages long, probably. Which is good that I wasn't, you know, that people intervened.
That's funny. How about you, Steve?
I think, I really like writing. I mean, I'm trying to, like, wean myself away from writing things that are, like, kind of cartoonishly comedic. Because I think it's unsatisfying on some level to read that. But for me, like the most fun that I had in writing this book is that Julie, one of the main characters, is running an Airbnb out of her house. And I rent a lot of Airbnbs because I go there to write, and I also couldn't afford to do that indefinitely, so I kind of bought some real estate and I rent it out through Airbnb. And so I know a lot about Airbnbs, and I loved writing about that world. I just think it's so kind of interesting and strange, the idea that in a society where we are kind of obsessed with privacy on some level, even though people are putting everything online, that people are letting complete strangers into their houses and sharing their most intimate spaces with them. And it was really fun writing about that and exploring it. And I could have written, I mean, it's the same thing, like you could have written a 500-page dialogue, but, you know, I could have written 500 pages easily on Airbnb, you know, with no plot and just endless digressions. And, you know,
sort of like the addendum.
Yeah. The outtakes.
Experimental novel.
Yeah. Well, and you get all the pleasure of like real estate too. Like we're in this like big falling apart house with all its little details and all the weirdness of the people who come through. So it's like this kind of double shot of pleasure.
Yeah. So it's like you could, you know, have endless without any real resolution or plot. You know, just people arriving and doing crazy things. So anyway.
Yeah. I think that's another thing that I loved about all of your books is the sense of going into the private world of the characters in this really intimate way. Mm-hmm. And probably what I love about novels anyway is that when the really good ones take you deeply inside the world, and I really appreciated that about all of your novels. Okay, so I've asked you about the easy part. What was maybe the most difficult or most challenging? You can see that.
There's so much.
Yeah. Like where do you begin? Okay, pick one, pick two. Well,
for me, it was at the it was like at the 2/3 mark of the book, which I assume other people have trouble with that point, because I got there and then wrote past it, and I couldn't figure out how to resolve the book, so I just kept kept moving the characters forward and forward in time, and eventually realized I'd overwritten the book. I guess this is the theme of what I'm saying, but you know, it was really hard once you get characters into a situation to figure out like what would be a satisfying resolution to it. At least I found that. That might be really basic, but it was really, really tricky to be like, where does this end in a way that actually feels like a real ending to a story rather than just an arbitrary cutoff point.
So how did you arrive to that point? Like, how did you know?
I don't know if I did.
Okay.
But I kind of, to me, it felt like, where are we where there's still tension enough that you're, like, curious at the end about what happens next? To me, that was what I wanted. Like, I don't really like books that just wrap everything up at the end. Like, even though I love, you know, classical, whatever, tragedy and comedy where everything gets wrapped up, I feel like there was no way. This is a book about people in their late 20s, early 30s. Like, the rest is still to come, you know? So I wanted to leave it at a point where you were like, huh, I wonder what they'll do next. You know, I wonder what'll happen next. And so I kind of tried to hit a place where you weren't bored yet.
For me, it was, I think, one of the hardest things was to strike that balance between writing a relationship between a, like, defiantly and definitely lesbian person and a straight man, in a way where we could believe that she would do it, right? So he had to be charming enough, likable enough, that she would actually do this. And yet also, I realized as I started to have straight readers from the publishing house, et cetera, to push against 7 million years of like heterosexual romance expectations and having people say, I secretly hoped it would all work out with them. And I'm like, that's a tragedy. Like, that's actually, like, they, like, striking that balance of like plausibility and yet also complete implausibility of what goes on between them.
I really appreciated and love that about your book because Ryan, right, who is the guy, you could imagine how the line got blurred. And yet there was always that sense, and I'm as a straight person, you know, there was a little bit of part of me going, well, maybe, but on the other hand, I love that there was some genuine connection that felt good enough, really, in many ways. But it's complicated, so you have to read the book.
Yeah. It's complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, I think my biggest challenge was somewhat related to that, which is that you have these two previously married couple, and he's gay now, and she's remarried, although that marriage is falling apart. But I wanted it to really be a love story about those two people, although it could not be a traditional one in the sense that it was not going to end with a happy marriage. And so the most challenging thing for me was like trying to figure out a way to make their connection convincing and loving and intimate and all of those things without having it be some disappointed, romance, really, so that it felt like an authentic friendship that had maybe an extra element in it without pushing it over the edge. And I think actually what helped it was the age of the characters, because I think people's expectations change as they get older for what they want out of a relationship. And so that made it maybe a little bit easier.
Or some kind of, although your character was younger, but I love sort of this sort of tolerance for something that's just not black and white.
Yeah.
That to me was interesting about all your books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you sort of take, also for some reason, like I was writing this book in the spring, summer, and fall of 2016, which was a fraught period for some of us, which is, remains a fraught period for some of us. But anyway, and I really liked entering a world in this novel when I was writing it of, people being kind to each other. Mm-hmm. And without it being phony, hopefully. When you take away, and I was thinking about I've done a lot of acts of kindness with the expectation that there would be, sexual reward at the end, helping somebody move, put their shit into the loading van and so on, moving van and so on and so forth.
Some people just want pizza.
Huh?
Some people just expect pizza.
Yeah, I'm in it for the beer.
And when you eliminate that possibility, that people have to actually be motivated by genuine fondness for someone with no expectation that they're going to be getting anything in return.
Wow. So that's a wild concept.
Yeah.
That's really good.
That's pretty amazing. So let's see. I want to just check them. We're good. Okay. I think now that we have a little context with the books and a little chatter, I'm just going to ask you all just to read a little snippet, a couple of minutes maybe or less, from each of your books. Maybe you want to start?
Okay. This is a very abbreviated version of the first few pages of the novel, which I put on, big print so I wouldn't have to wear my glasses, but I'm going to anyway. No, it was not the happiest moment of David Hedge's life. Soren, his partner of 5 years, had left him. He'd gotten fat, and somewhere in the midst of that, he'd woken up one day and realized he was no longer in his 20s or his 40s. The last person he expected to hear from was Julie Fisk. He and Julie had a history, albeit an ancient and complicated one. They hadn't seen each other in almost 30 years, hadn't spoken in more than 20, and David assumed that their story, like a few other things in his life, his desire to visit Petra, his vow to study piano, his sexual relevance, had ended. This didn't diminish her importance to him. His memories of her lingered on, faded by the years in flattering ways. In his mind, they were still best friends. He'd heard of Julie Fisk infrequently through a few mutual friends and had pieced together scraps and come to the conclusion that she had a happy life. She taught art at a private school for kids with learning problems, not what she'd imagined for herself in her younger incarnation, but who was he to judge? They'd been in touch sporadically for a while after the divorce, and then she'd met and eventually married Henry Bell, an investment advisor David had had the pleasure of never meeting. David wasn't good at making money with money, and he was suspicious of people who were, especially when they did it with other people's money, an activity he equated with plagiarism. Over the years, David had thought of trying to see her when he went east to visit family, but he'd never followed through. The period of life they'd shared was his ex-life, and he was resigned to leave it at that. And then one day, during that season of his aggrieved discontent, he received a phone call from Julie Fisk that changed everything. So that's the setup for
that's
the book.
That's very cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. That's so moving to me in the sense, it's funny, but there's a sense of these old ghosts from the past that sort of live in us, and it's so weird how things do kind of surface at these I don't know, it's seemingly serendipitous moments, like it seemed for him. He was thinking about her, and then she kind of, you know, showed up. I think that's kind of
cool. Well, one thing when I mentioned the title of this book, like people start talking about, you know, how they're stalking old boyfriends and, you know, ex-spouses and so on Facebook, and and they always say, but I'd never do anything about it. I hope, you know, it would never go anywhere, which is never true. You know, that's always what's behind it on some level,
yeah.
I think. Anyway,
it's interesting because, again, and you'll read from yours too, but there is this sense for all of you that of the culture that we're living in. And somehow I feel like that's kind of bled through and influenced something. We can talk more about that, but maybe Chelsea, you can read a little bit from yours.
Okay, I'll just read the very first few paragraphs from the book. So, Portland in the 90s was a lot like me. Broke, struggling with employment, mostly white, mostly hopeful, even though there was no real change in sight. For all the drive-through espresso stands and downtown restoration, the new paint on aged bungalows and vintage glasses on young women, it was still an old industrial river town in a remote corner of the country. Hard to get to, hard to leave. The town matched something in me, the way a certain kind of guitar dissonance could strike an internal tuning fork that made my bones hum. I loved the slightly ruined quality of everything, the rusted joints, the mossy edges, the containers stacked in the weeds by the train tracks, the evergreen hills striped pale green with recovering clear cuts. I'd go out to Kelly Point, where the Columbia and Willamette Rivers met, and the near-empty beach would be populated by enormous satiny driftwood trunks and rusting hunks of industrial debris, Latino families fishing and white dog owners throwing sticks, and lonely men waiting for furtive sex in the woods while long, low barges slid slowly by. All of us out at the end of the country, hoping for a quick, small fix. Tech money kept on puffing up Seattle and San Francisco like toxic blowfish, but skipped right over Portland. We just got the leftovers, the priced out queers and artists, and the ongoing plague of gleeful professionals who couldn't believe how much Oregon House you could get on a California dollar. Seattle's grunge explosion had raised some hopes, but left only a patter of shrapnel here. The Portland sound, there was no single such thing, couldn't be packaged and sold so easily. The major label searchlights turned elsewhere, and the music still flourished in the dark, mushrooming in basements and garages and warehouse practice spaces, in crammed clubs and beat-up ballrooms. All of which is to say, there was no money in the place. No matter, all the better. Young people kept coming, seeking all the things you'd expect, music, work, drugs, adulthood, refuge from adulthood, but mostly seeking each other. We came from dying logging towns in the Rocky Coast, from Salem and Nehalem and Battleground and Boring, runaways from Boise, SoCal misfits, kids from the South and Midwest, the suburbs of anywhere. Some stayed a month, others a year or two, some stuck around. Me, I came at 17 from rural western Nebraska, where adulthood came hard and fast and narrow, and queers kept quiet or met violence. Here, I was no longer the only, but one of an ever-gathering crowd. Young forever, queer forever, friends forever, or so we all thought then. My people. It's up there.
So. Awesome.
Yeah. Makes you just want to not say anything for a second. Because when you hear all these, it's just, again, I want to say these books are wonderful. So I know it's hard to just follow each other, but let's just get a taste of yours too.
But I wanted to say to Stephen that my mother, who teaches kids with learning disabilities, married her investor boyfriend after re-meeting him on Facebook after they dated in high school. So it's like basically.
So he got your story.
Yeah.
I feel like I relate very strongly.
I think she'd like a copy of my book. You should send me.
Honestly, she's going to be freaked out by it.
Wow.
I'll have you sign one to her. Okay, I'll read the beginning of my book as well. Like most people trying to get by in something like the regular current of American life, I don't act like a total asshole to most people I meet, and I'm generally regarded as pretty nice, mainly because I leave myself vulnerable to hearing out other people's crises and complaints for longer, on average, than would be merely polite. And the fact is, I do tend to like people in practice, even though I've built an airtight case against them in principle. It's a natural response, I guess, to being raised by relatively kind parents who taught me to be polite and decent and to rely on the company and help of others, but to also consider myself smarter and, on some fundamental level, more deserving of complete fulfillment than anyone in the world besides maybe my sisters. This may be why, when my girlfriend, Julia, asked me to meet her at the house of a recent acquaintance of ours, a New Age-leaning woman named Anna, whose family, through what specific brand of plunder, I don't know, owned a gigantic house out in horse country, I agreed. Julia would be arriving late from a shift in the ICU and wanted me to be the advance guard. She believed this dinner held the potential for a better-than-usual time, since it brought together a number of people we didn't know very well but had been told we would like. Of course, the people we would like often turned out to be amateur poets and holistic healers, but to her eternal credit, this didn't stop Julia from holding out hope for social transcendence, the nature of which I didn't fully understand. My goals at these things usually extended no further than making at least one moderately clever comment and trying not to spill anything on my shirt. With the address Julia had given me, I followed my glitchy ancient GPS to the mechanized gate marking the entrance to Anna's family compound. The architecture ahead was nouveau hunting lodge, polished wood and the kind of low modernist arrangements I'd encountered at expensive hotels in underdeveloped countries with my parents. I parked in front of something designed to look like a former stable and wandered around the main residence, casing it for an entrance. As I passed the window, I saw the profile of a woman staring fixedly into the distance, moving her lips in spirited chatter. Her long dark hair was pulled into a messy upward configuration, held in delicate balance by a pencil, maybe. She stood erect, shoulders squared, but she seemed comfortable, at ease in her formality. She was standing at a kitchen counter, chopping something on a cutting board. This first ghostly observation of Leslie remains significant in my mind, since it was the only time I saw her, ever will see her, without knowing anything about her. That's it. That's good.
All right, thank you. Oh, ghostly, too, that sense of, I don't know, ghosts of either things that you're imagining for the future or things you're carrying from behind.
The ghost of Christmas future, yeah.
All of those things, or the
scariest ghost.
Could be, yeah. Although it seems like the past kind of does a lot of damage, too. But, so I was wondering again how you sort of managed your sense of the culture or the times in terms of your stories, if you felt conscious of that. I mean, I know, you know, you're set in 1990s, you're a little more, you were saying 2016. I feel like, it's like, what, 20, the time?
It's 2015.
2015,
yeah.
Okay. So
it's right before the fall.
Yeah, okay. Just how much did that sort of shape anything, or did it not, or were you aware of it or not aware of it? Were you escaping from it? Mm-hmm. Just wondering, anybody?
I've really deliberately set mine in the late 90s for a couple of reasons. One is that identity politics were way more stringent back then, so it created more tension for my character to let cross those lines. And also because I wanted to write about an analog time where you could really escape from people. You could really hide. Like, if you left your house, you were unreachable. Like, you were gone. It was much less of, like, the kind of trail we leave around each. It's much easier to keep a secret, I think, when nobody can find you or text you or whatever, and you just are where you are when you are, and that's it. Mm. And it was fun to write about that time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like Stephen, I was writing about, I wrote this in 2015 and into 2016, and with increasing political anxiety in the air. And I wrote an essay about this, about writing a version of the book after the election in 2016, in which I like added in all this political content, and suddenly the characters are all like, oh, did you see the primary debates last night? Oh, gosh, yeah, Ted Cruz, ugh. And, you know, and like, but Trump will never win, and that, you know, if someone says that like every 10 pages. And my editor was like, you gotta get rid of this stuff. Like, it's just not, it's a book about before that moment. It's a book about, I mean, and obviously they're political and they talk about politics, but, and also to set it in Charlottesville, and we were in final edits when the, like, you know, horrible fascists marched through Charlottesville, and it was hard to also write this knowing that they didn't know that was coming, you know. So that was sort of an interesting debate in my head constantly, like how much of this should I foreshadow and how much should I leave unsaid. And I left most of it unsaid because
Do you think that would have now, I mean, in retrospect, shifted anything? Is that, do you think it really would have mattered ultimately, or I'm just curious, because when you're writing a story that's set in the present time, and the present time is always moving.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it would have been hard to write a book about, they're so glib, and they're my age, and like, you know, it's not like, a lot of my friends are political and have been political forever, but I mean, on November, whatever, 6th, 8th, like, everything about the way we talk about our lives and the way we think about the future changed in a really dramatic way, you know, and suddenly we were marching every weekend, and, you know, it was just different, and then I think if I'd started the book after that date, I would have felt compelled to write in a different way. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know if that's a good thing, honestly, for literature or for art. I'm not sure it is a good thing, but it would have been a different book. Sure.
But it put some frame around, maybe created some pseudo frame or something. Yeah.
But I also think that, you know, like, I mean, that is kind of a challenge because at the same time that people are marching and are more, I mean, there's just kind of a level of anxiety and uncertainty right now among the people that I know and hang out with anyway, that at the same time everyone's still obsessed with, you know, who they're going to meet this weekend and if they're going to get laid and so on and so forth. And I mean, you know, but when you write about that in a book, if you, you know, somehow, I mean, I sort of feel like, well, I'm writing about, like, you know, white middle class people living in the first world, and their problems are to them just like my problems are to me, you know, serious and important and so on. In the grand scheme of things, they're really not. And that writing in a more comedic vein, you know, or that they're at least aware of that fact and can comment on it and, you know, ironically, mitigates the, you know, the self-indulgence a little bit somehow or other. Mm-hmm. But I never read, like, you know, Goodreads or anything, but I was recently...
Oh, you sure you
now
do.
He does.
No, I really don't. But someone was asking me a question at this one of these things, and he said, well, there are all these people on Goodreads writing about, you know, how, you know, they're appalled by the liberal politics and the characters and, you know, so on and so forth. And I mean, that I was like, I was so thrilled, you know, that was what they were objecting to. So. Mm.
Okay.
Somewhere it's transgressive to be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
middle class liberal.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I guess that kind of raises again that idea of sensitivity to the times or to what a reader is thinking. I don't know. You were saying that the 90s was there's some more clarity there. The tension was greater because there was less acceptance maybe today in terms of transgender, queer, whatever. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if in the end, well, I guess that does, you can't, you live in your time, so as a writer you can't really not be affected by things like that, it seems like. But
Do you think identity politics really were more, you're saying they were more strictly policed, do you think, in the late 90s than now?
I think in queer politics they certainly were in lesbian politics, because now so many people who would have maybe identified as lesbian then are non-binary or they're trans or there's just a broader spectrum of gender, and so it's harder to be like, people don't necessarily claim lesbian as like their identity anymore. Yeah. And when that's kind of blurred, things get, and also I think we've just kind of gotten a little bit more flexible about people shouldn't just be bisexual or whatever it might be.
It's not betraying the cause.
Yeah, and also, I mean, also at the end of the 90s, like when you think about like what defined queer culture in the 90s, it was the AIDS crisis. Like it was life or death, like stakes, like battlefield style. And I think that coming out of that, a lot of queers were still feeling really bruised about it and therefore really protective of like the identity and of the culture and of, you know, and the, especially lesbians didn't really exist in pop culture. It was like Chasing Amy or like whatever. They always in popular representations went to a man, so I think we were particularly sensitive to that kind of thing. Thinking about what you were saying too, Stephen, it kind of gets back to that hilarity heartache thing, right, which is I think comedy is the an apt response to tragedy, you know?
Yeah.
Like 20 years later?
Yeah, or even now.
I mean,
what keeps us, like, think about, like, when we used to, like, cling to the Daily Show during the Bush years or whatever. Or,
oh,
like,
that's
even
true.
Now, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you need the humor, like, helps you make sense of the horror better than anything.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like most of my friends, and probably me too, it's like, you know, you just have these periods where you say, okay, I'm on news blackout, but mm-hmm. you're still listening, watching, you know, Stephen Colbert or something, which is transforming it into mm-hmm. comedy. I'm not sure that that's ultimately useful, mm-hmm. you know, politically, but nonetheless, it is what I think a lot of us do.
Mm. That's survival.
Yeah.
And my partner, Laura, said the other night we should be laughing more at these terrible men, you know, like bringing them down in some ways by, not to put that on her, but you know, that is also something you can do. That's also an effective mm-hmm. tool is to diminish the power of some mm-hmm. of these people rather than accepting their power, is to undermine their power by recognizing their ridiculousness rather than saying like, oh gosh, you're so powerful. Yes, please. You know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So I have like, probably it's more and more of a writerly question, but just how you arrived at your titles. Mm. Was that easy? Did you struggle over it?
I had so many bad titles. I had like just like an endless list of bad titles that people rejected.
Like what?
like the working title forever was The Height of Her Powers.
Okay.
And people just shot it down. Yeah. I had.
I think that was a good thing, actually. Early Work is such a great title.
Yeah, it's a good title.
No, the title. I like the title in the end. Yeah. It was called like Some Other Way of Living. Was a title for a while after like a Merle Haggard song.
Yeah.
it was called Now I Want to Be Your Dog for a while. Right. Which is like not appropriate really to the book. I don't know. Did your guys's come?
Yeah,
natural?
Mine had a really bad title, working title too. It's called Not For You to Know, which is impossible. Which I liked the idea of, but it's impossible to remember. Like I don't like titles that have like too many prepositions in it, no concrete nouns, you know.
Yeah.
So it was like, it was time to send the book out, and my agent was just like, can we think of a new title? And I sat there. Yeah, it was impossible to think of a title. And then my partner was like giving out words, and she started to say the word estranged, and I heard stray, and I was like, oh, stray. I was like, stray. And then suddenly it was just there. And I was like, that's it. There it is. There it is. There's like stray animals in it. The people are strays.
Yep.
They, you know, they've all accumulated in this city. Yeah. So then it was like, it was a huge relief to come on it and know that that was going to be it. And I'm really glad it's not the long, forgettable one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it allowed for there to be an animal on the cover,
yeah,
which is like always a good
perfect excuse for a cat.
Yeah. Yeah.
People will be like, is this book about cats?
Kind of.
Yeah. Yes. That's the answer. Yeah. Sure.
Yes. Do you like cats?
Yeah.
Right. What about you, Stephen?
I always struggle with titles, and this is the only one I didn't, in a sense, because I kind of sent out 100 pages before the novel was finished, and you know, the agent who was sending them out said, you know, well, you should put a title on it. So I said, oh, I'll just put on My Ex-Life, and it was like, that was the only thing people said. Oh, never change that title. That's great. And I was like, really?
It came to you out of nowhere. You just threw it on there?
I guess it was like somewhere in my subconscious.
Well, you read your pages, and you had something about. The line there.
Yeah, but that came in later.
Oh, did it come in later?
Yeah. Did you add it later?
No, of course. I kept adding it, you know. It's mentioned a few times in the book. I sort of, for some reason, like, I feel like there's something kind of sweet when you're reading a novel and the title enters into it somehow or other, unless it's kind of forced in. There's something appealing.
I forced mine in at the end.
You did. Yeah.
Like towards the end, I was like, oh yeah, someone's got to say Early Work.
Yeah.
Like that scene in Face Off, you know, when it's like, you want to take his face off?
Yeah.
And then he just keeps saying it. Yeah. It's like that.
So I think we have about 10 minutes or something, and we can take a little bit of time for some questions. And I think we have a mic here in the front. So if you want to come up to the mic and ask the question, it would be preferable. And then we'll give you a warning that we're done. And again, I want to remind everybody that you can purchase the books in the back table. And then you just go out the door, and the authors will be there to sign. So really encourage you to buy these wonderful books, great presents and all that.
Well, thanks so much for being here. I really enjoyed listening to all of you. I've read Stephen's book. It was wonderful.
Can everybody hear this mic, by the way? Okay, I'll probably repeat the question once you've asked then.
I'm just wondering, I know Andrew mentioned something about working with his editor, and I'm just wondering about your relationships with your agents and editors and what that's like, if it's mostly suggestions that you agree with, if you think it makes your books better overall, or if you feel like, what do you need to do to push back sometimes, what that is like.
Okay, so just quickly, she's asking when they're working with their agents and editors, if there's pushback or what the influence there is in terms of the writing and the work.
Mm. I mean, I hate everything I write, and so like if someone says, you know, change everything, I'm like, oh, okay, I'll change everything. You know, I agree with you. But I actually love the collaborative process of like working with an editor and taking suggestions and having someone see things in your work that you didn't see, whether it's strengths or in most cases weaknesses. And then, I mean, I think it's wonderful. I love it. It's one of my favorite things, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I adore my agent, and he, both my agent and my editor were very supportive of the book and just gave like a couple of crucial suggestions. And my agent's crucial suggestion is, what if you cut part two? Which was originally 150 pages long and now is like 30. And I realized he was right. It was like the first thing I'd written, and it was all Ryan's point of view. Like, it was present tense. It took place over like 5 days. It was just a lot of thinking and feeling and observing. It was super boring. So before we sent it out, he was like, part two's a little boring. And I just, should I cut it? He said, yeah, would you? And I said, sure. And I just condensed it to like, it's a list of emails and phone calls and transcripts. And it becomes like just this kind of multimedia montage. So that was one thing that happened. But I've never had that experience of like, oh, we're coming to blows, like you're destroying my art or whatever. And then my editor was also, she had, I mean, there's that kind of classic writing advice that people will often, they won't know how to fix it, but they'll know that something's wrong. So they'll make suggestions of like, what if you did this? And you're like, well, I shouldn't do that, but you're right that you're pointing out at me, you know?
Yeah.
So it was great. It was all good for me.
Yeah, I mean, I cut a lot out of this book, and it was my agent and editor who suggested it. And, you know, my agent said, oh, it should be 10,000 words shorter, and I cut it. And then when I was in the process of selling it, the editor said, well, you know, this is about 100,000 words, and I'll buy it, but it has to, I'm going to put it in the contract that it has to be 75,000 words. Uh-huh. And it was a big risk at the time. I was like, should I hold out? Should I? And I was like, you know what? Actually, like, he made a compelling argument. I felt good about it. And then it was remarkably not easy to do it, but once you started looking for stuff that was dead on the page or that wasn't as interesting or whatever, it was like, I was really, really happy that I did that. Mm. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm always curious about the writer's process. And do you have the vision of where it's going to end? So do you know how your characters are going to end up or how the plot's going to end before you start? With Andrew, I felt like you were very clear that it was evolving as you were writing it.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering about Chelsea and Stephen and what you say about that.
I knew that, I as I said, it started out as a totally different story, as Ryan's story, and Andrea was a secondary character, and then she took over the book. So in that sense, I had no idea what it was going to turn into. And I don't even know if I would have known how to write it if I'd been like, I'm going to write a story about this culture that I was a part of and that I miss. You know, it had to be about somebody else, and that came in kind of sideways. That said, like, once I kind of figured that out, I knew it was going to be three parts, and I knew that at the very end, these three crucial characters were going to be in the same place for just, like, a few pages, and I just had to figure out how to get there. Mm. But if you plan too much and outline too much, it just gets dead. It just becomes labor. You're, like, checking off the boxes and kind of filling in the blanks, and it reads terribly, but then, of course, if you have no idea what you're doing, you can also wander down some pretty gnarly paths for a while, which I did for a few years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of knew where I wanted the book to go, but I wasn't sure how it would get there or if it would get there. Mm-hmm. And I also wrote this book completely out of sequence, because usually I've written everything else kind of, you know, chronologically, you know, as the book unfolds. And in this case, I just kind of went to the library every day and said, like, what is a possible scene involving these characters that I feel like writing today? And I did that, and so I ended up with a huge number of pages that I didn't use, but and things that had to keep you know, being reorganized in the manuscript, but it was actually a very liberating way to write.
That's really heartening. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a writing teacher, you know, when I was getting an MFA, and he said, you know, just make a list of all the scenes that you want to write and choose the one you want to write first, and don't worry about connecting the dots. And I was never able to do that, but it's now like my favorite thing.
Oh, I'm gonna do that.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, because like the worst thing about writing is like trying to get the people, you know, off the couch and into the next room, and how do they get from Tuesday to Wednesday? And
like the dutiful scene.
Yeah.
Like,
yes,
exactly. There has to be a bridge scene where they have this argument now, and I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And then you always end up cutting that anyway. So.
Right.
So, no, I highly recommend it if you're writing
a
novel.
Yeah, I love that. I love that too.
I heard too Lonnie Davis give writing advice once, which is just go through your manuscript and highlight every line that you like, and then cut everything else. And you kind of did that writing-wise. You only wrote the parts you wanted to write.
I thought it was going to be cut everything that you like.
No,
thank
God.
No.
It was like, just keep your darlings. Ditch the rest.
Oh, okay, I like that.
But there'd be like 7 pages in the damn book.
Yeah. It'd save our editors a lot of time.
Yeah, sure.
But what about you, Jessica? Because, you know, your wonderful novel, which is for sale, Strangers in Budapest in the back, is a terrific, you know, novel, and it's full of kind of suspense and atmosphere. And how did you construct that?
I'm not the plotting type, so this is unusual for me. But I labored, and I did go through a point where I had 5 points of view, and I had an outline, and that made the novel so much worse. Mm-hmm. So I put it back in the drawer, and then I took out all the voice. You know, it's down to 2 voices. And I had to rework the sort of last third many times. Mm-hmm. This novel in progress that I'm working on now, I'm doing more of what you're talking about, and it's liberating.
Yeah.
But messy. I always allow for a mess. I've just gotten used to just saying it's, you know, that's just part of the process. Mm-hmm. So I guess we just have 1 minute left. So maybe a really fast question?
That's a good sign.
Oh, good. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks for asking.
Since the topic is hilarity and heartache, my question is, to get to the funny in the best possible way, how tortured do you have to make your characters, and vice versa, for punch?
Oh, I like that.
That's a really good question. Well, isn't that like kind of basic comedy, somebody falls, like on a banana peel, right? So you just make your characters fall. Like, how can I make them fall again and again and again in a way that's, you're like, ow, that hurts, but also that was kind of hilarious at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything's very funny unless the people are really miserable, right? I mean, it's like, there's nothing funny about, like, happy people. Yeah. Like, oh, great.
Happy, well-adjusted people.
It's fun to, like, make fun of those people, but it's not, like, fun. They're not funny, really. Like only miserable people are funny, I think. It's coming out of some horrible place, probably. Maybe not.
It's coping.
Or a funny place.
Yeah.
Or a funny place.
I have to like make sure that I'm not being mean to my characters by making them so miserable and sort of laughing at their expense. That's the only thing that I think is kind of the balance that's
some
important
empathy,
to strike.
Maybe.
Yeah, you want to help them back up, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that is time. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Buy the book.
Thank you. Thank you for moderating.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.